Morning, Council. We have a, before we start argument in earnest, we have a couple of housekeeping matters to determine. First of all, the exhibit, Mr. Olson has asked to use it as a demonstrative aid. It's contained in his brief, and so we will allow the use of that exhibit this morning. I also wanted to mention that we did receive Mr. Alston's motion to dismiss his moot yesterday afternoon. Obviously, the opposing parties have not had an opportunity to respond, and so we will not take argument on the motion this morning. We'll decide it in due course. All right, good. And in terms of the argument time, parties have reserved time for each of their component arguments. So we'll start this morning with Mr. Geschel and your argument on your appeal.
Thank you very much. Good morning, and hope we get some final resolution in this case. This case actually started in the year 2000.
Mr. Geschel, excuse me, can you make your appearance for the record?
Oh, I'm sorry, I thought the clerk did that. Stephen Geschel and Thomas Dunn for the appellants, Tom and Marina J. Schmidt.
Thank you.
And they're also the cross, what is it, appellees in the appeal that deals with the attorney's fees and the statute of limitations, which the Supreme Court already decided. So I really don't know what that's about here, because they already decided that we were correct, that the nature of the fraudulent transfer is what they have to discover, not just simply that there was a transfer. So is it okay to pull this down?
Sure.
It's sticking right up in my face. So anyway, back to what I was saying about that this case really had its genesis in the year 2000 when Kevin S.C. Chang decided that the excess sale proceeds in a foreclosure action belonged to the lender, not the borrower, contrary to the statutes, contrary to case law. Then that case came up on appeal, and this court said that Kevin Chang was right. And so I entered the case, and we took the case to the Supreme Court. They said that the Schmidts were right, that Kevin Chang and the ICA were wrong, that the excess sale proceeds belonged to the borrower, of course, because that was their property. So
Mr. Geschel,
yes.
First of all, I want to apologize for interrupting you and peppering you with questions, but because there's two arguments here, there's some things I really want to ask you, and so I'm going to interrupt you.
Please.
And this has been back and forth to this court as well, so we have some of the background here. Now, you're talking about February 2000, and the defendants or the appellees focus a lot on February 2000 because that's when the money came out from the foreclosure action.
Wait a minute. No, the appellees didn't do that.
Okay, but let me just finish my question.
It was RFI. Yeah.
Okay, you correct me when I'm wrong. Okay, but let me finish my question. Okay, so I'm talking about the brief. Now, what happened in February 2000 was there's those four checks that are listed in your complaint, in your amended complaint. You're with me on that, right? The four checks that went out. Okay, but this goes to my question, which is, isn't your case broader than just those four checks? Isn't your allegation really that while that earlier case from Kevin Chang sort of was pending on appeal from 2000 to 2004, that RFI was essentially bled dry for the benefit of the defendants. Not necessarily it didn't all go to them, but for their benefit. So are we looking just at those four checks as the fraudulent transfers, or is your allegation broader?
Broader.
Okay.
$986,000 that these two guys, the CPAs, bankrupted the RFI with their paying the paying the stockholder and the stockholder's creditors instead of waiting to pay in a dissolution where they're supposed to do it.
Okay, now the problem that I see is that doesn't appear to be in the First Amended complaint. That the First Amended complaint speaks to those first four transfers and not the others. Did you or your predecessor, counsel, seek to amend the complaint or ask the court to consider that additional evidence as also being part of the fraudulent transfers?
Well, there was no predecessor in the counsel, okay?
Right.
So, but I, you know, we tried this case in 2008, and it's pretty hard to remember, but I'm pretty sure that we put all the evidence in that shows the fraudulent intent of RFI. That's what the focus was on for the elements. So those checks, those other checks that were distributed, the other money that went out from the coffers of RFI so they could loot the company and exclude the Smiths from getting the $537,000 back that was due them in 2000, that proves fraudulent intent in spades.
Okay. And on the $537,000, is that the remedy you're seeking, a judgment against the appellees for $537,000? Because obviously you're not going to go back to First Hawaiian Bank because they're not even a party. You're not going back to some of the other transfers. Are you looking for, you know, if you went back to trial, is that the relief you're seeking at this time? A money judgment?
Yes.
Okay. For $537,000.
Plus interest.
Okay.
At 10% per annum. From
against
the,
whom?
For the last part?
Against whom?
Against the dependents.
Okay. Against
HSC whom? And Mr. and Mrs. Henderson.
Okay. Jointly and severally.
Yes.
Okay. And they distinguish between...
And not only that, but there are other remedies under 651C-, I think it's 9. There's four remedies. And we want any and all remedies to which they're entitled, including setting aside the transfers of money, which would mean the money comes back into the coffers.
Okay, but you're not seeking to set aside money against anyone who's not a party to this case.
Not right now, no. No, they're not. Gosh, this, no, I don't think so. We've only been going on this for now 10 years, so.
Right, okay. And then I have one more question that I really want to have answered, and I apologize again for interrupting you.
That's okay. I'm here to answer the questions. Paul Alston wanted to be here and argue and tell you that my brief was all full of rife with lies and distortions and
but
everything.
But I don't want to talk about that right now.
Well, he wants to.
I want to ask you, the defendants in their brief say that the distinction between an investment or an investor, in this case HSC's and the Henderson's investment, and the debt owed to a present or future creditor is irrelevant. In other words, they say that because HSC was an investor, it's the same as if it was a creditor. That's what the trial court said. The difference is irrelevant. What I want from you, if you can answer this, is what are the strongest authorities for that support your case, which is there is a difference between paying your creditor and paying your money up to your parent corporation?
Well, in the first place, the evidence was undisputed, Your Honor, that both the witnesses for the defense, Mr. Henderson and Mr. Chigami, clearly said that what HSC invested in RFI was capital. Capital is not a debt. HSC was the sole stockholder of this company, this RFI, that's still on the shelf over there with the DCCA, last check, last month. It's a hollowed out corporation. So what they did was, the money that the HSC put in was stock, in essence. It's not, it's capital, it's not a debt.
Right, but they say that's that distinction is irrelevant, and I'm saying, do you have any cases cited in your brief, or do you have any authority for the proposition that it's that distinction is relevant to this court?
I think I do. I think that it's in there, and here's the case. You ready?
I'm ready.
American looks like Security Bank versus Bank of Honolulu, where you always got a good deal. 646 Fed Sup, 1063 at the Battle of Hastings, 1066. And that's Hawaii District Court, Federal, 1986. In our reply brief at page 7.
Thank you.
And that says, stockholders are not creditors. Bingo. End of story. Now, do you have any more questions, Your Honor?
No.
I'll be happy to answer them.
Thank you for your tolerance.
Okay. Because the judge, Nakamura, found that was that these were creditors, HSCs were creditors, and that's just totally wrong, legally and factually. There was no evidence that HSC was a creditor. What they did was, you had, not you, but they had two CPAs, not cleaning, pressing, and alterations, certified public accountants. Now these guys are running a thrift loan company. They know about money matters. They also know about corporate dissolution, because that's what CPAs are always confronted with. Not only that, but this RFI was represented by Ashford and Wriston, and their lawyer got $97,000 for convincing Judge Kevin Chang that the excess sale proceeds belong to the borrower, I mean to the lender, if you can believe that. Okay, so now, they concealed all of these facts that the corporation was raided, so that by 2002, before the Supreme Court decided this case, and probably before this court decided the case, those two CPAs had already raided, looted this company, and made it insolvent. And that's the basis of this lawsuit, because they prevented the Schmitz from getting the money back from this looted company. And they did it by design, and we proved that. All of the exhibits most of the exhibits that are on these two volumes, I brought them today, just look at all that paperwork. You've been studying this case for 5 years, so you probably know that most of the exhibits came from the defendant, from the RFI's records and HSC's records. And they did the looting without a board meeting. The two CPAs just said, well, we'll just take this money and pay back the money that HSC borrowed to cover the FDIC requirement that they put tier one capital in this company because it was undercapitalized according to the FDIC. And that's where the money went, into RFI's capital account. It was not a debt. So they were not paying creditors back. It's a preference in the law of bankruptcy.
Mr. Geschel, for purposes of our review, at this point, we're reviewing the trial court's findings. A lot of your challenges on appeal are as to findings of fact. And the circuit court, Judge Nakamura, had to apply a clear and convincing evidence test, right, for purposes of your claim, the fraud claim. So the trial court had to apply a clear and convincing evidence.
Yes. Oh,
right?
Sure.
Right. So that's the standard, and we're now reviewing his determinations of findings of fact. And my specific question to you.
Did you say you're not reviewing?
We are reviewing.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
When you said that, I thought.
We are.
Yes.
So it's a little closer here. We're reviewing, in large part because those are the points of error that you have raised there as to findings of fact. Okay. In terms of the evidence, and I just want to make sure I understand this, your point is the intent that we are looking at in terms of whether there was actual intent to hinder, delay, or defraud your clients is the intent by Mr. Henderson and Mr. Chigami.
Wrong.
Okay, who's intent? What, in terms of the, and who is RFI?
RFI.
Who is RFI?
RFI is a corporation.
But we are looking at the intent and actions of particular individuals, are we not?
No, we're looking at the intent of RFI. That's where they led people down the wrong path. You see, it's the transferor's intent.
Right.
It's not the transferee's.
Who ran RFI?
So that's my question, exactly. Who is RFI?
Yeah, who ran?
It's a company.
Okay, but who are the principals of RFI? Who is running the company?
Henderson and Shigami were officers. They were officers in HSC.
Okay.
And vice president or treasurer. That's... It was interlocking directly.
Well, that's my point. I want to be sure I'm clear on your point as to what evidence we look at in terms of the relevant intent. Partly because, as I see in the briefs, there's a disagreement as to, for instance, whether we look at the intent of the receivers of these checks, the defendants in this case. I think you have pointed out that in Mr. Olson's brief, they're focusing on the wrong intent, the intent of the transferors. So as to that point, is Mrs. Henderson's intent relevant to our review?
It is if the defense claims that they acted in good faith.
Okay, so the defense under one of the provisions.
As a defense.
Okay.
And that case, Valvanus, there's a case Valvanus versus Holbrook or something like that. I saw it last night.
Yeah, we have it in the briefs, don't we?
Yeah, it's in there. I don't know if I do. The Valvanus case. Valvanus versus Holbro over in federal court, and I think it was Judge Seabright laid it all out as to when the elements of the claim under the UFTA, what they call a UFTA, is the elements require that the plaintiff prove by clear and convincing evidence that the transferor had the fraudulent intent.
Right, so
and
RFI.
I did that in spades, and I laid it out, and I listed them all in front of the trial court, and I attached that to the opening brief. And what did the defense do? They objected to me attaching things that are in the record on appeal, which is exactly what the rules say I can do. And I listed those for you in detail. And what did the defense do now? They said those facts are wrong. Did they go through and pick them apart? No. Did they do that in the answering brief? No. They want to come over here and call me a liar, and I object to that. I strongly do. Everything that about facts is that brief is correct, and I challenge. I can't wait to hear what he has to say about that.
Let me begin by responding to the questions that Judge Ganoza and Judge Leonard raised.
Mr. Alston,
yes.
If you could enter your appearance as well.
I will, Your Honor. This is Paul Alston and Key Campbell appearing for the Appellees Cross Appellants.
Thank you.
Thank you. And may it please the Court. The evidence is that Mr. Shigami and Mr. Henderson were officers of both RFI and HSC. So that in our brief, when we talk about their intent, the term defendant's intent is really shorthand for the intent of the transferee, because it's the same people. Right? We do not think, except as Mr. Geschel indicates, that the intent of the transferee controls, except with respect to the issue of good faith and the potential defense. It is the intent of the transferor, and it's the intent measured at the time the challenge transfers were made.
And I think I just wanted to clear up, and I think that's what I just wanted to clarify, is that it's the same people. It's,
yes.
It's Mr. Henderson and Mr. Shigami.
Yes.
Okay.
Now, there were other officers of RFI who were never heard from. They were never called to testify. Their views were never. But I think we would have to acknowledge that day-to-day, Mr. Shigami and Mr. Henderson were
For purposes of this record and the evidence in,
yes.
in the trial court, right?
Yes,
okay.
That's right. With respect to Ms. Henderson's intent, it is relevant in two respects. I mean, one is, you know, does the knowledge of the wife, the activities of the wife, bear on the thinking and intent of Mr. Henderson as the transferor? Yes. I mean, you know, if his wife knew something bad, you might draw an inference from that. And the other thing is, you know, she demonstrated through her trial testimony that she had advanced a lot of money that went to the benefit of RFI, and she expected to get it back someday. And so from the standpoint of her intent and from the standpoint of receiving
Mr. Alston, isn't the evidence that she advanced money to HSC, not RFI?
Yes, but expecting she advanced money to HSC with the understanding that it was going into RFI, I believe that's
okay, and those advances were capital contributions, correct?
They were put in as capital, that's right. And it is not our, let me turn to your questions because they're good ones. It is not our intent, it's not our statement that there is no difference between capital contributions made by a shareholder or an investor and the claims of third-party creditors. I mean, we all acknowledge that from the standpoint of distributing the assets of a corporation, the first obligation is to pay the third-party creditors. They stand on a higher footing than the shareholders do. Our proposition is that you simply can't say the shareholders don't have any expectation to a return of their capital or a return of their investments when the circumstances permit. And if I could, that ties directly into the Hawaii Business Corporations Act, Section 414.111, which relates to the distribution of assets by a corporation. And one of the things that statute provides is that the directors and the people running a company can rely on accounting information reasonably stated in making distributions to investors.
Okay, well, let's talk about some of those distributions, Mr. Alston. In the brief, there's a lot of discussion of Mr. Geschel's clients not seeking a stay. But isn't it true that at least those first four checks were out the door before judgment was even entered? Is that not true?
That's true.
Okay.
That's true. And it's also true that the complaint relates to those four checks.
I understood that. And I think, Mike, that was I tried to convey that in my questions anyway. So a stay would not have done them any good on that. And the other thing, and this goes to your brief, section 5A1 of your brief at page 15, and I'll read this to you. You make the statement, as a matter of law, fraud will not be found to exist if a party has acted in good faith reliance on a court order, since a party should be and is entitled to rely on court orders and judgments. And to me, that was an important argument. So I read each and every one of those seven cases that you cited for that proposition, and it appears that not a single one of those is a fraudulent transfers case or has anything to do with fraudulent transfers. So how does that proposition relate to this case, and how do those cases relate to this case?
Well, in order to establish the actual intent, they have to demonstrate something that bears on the thinking of the transferor at the time that the transfers are made. It may be true that those cases, it is true, I'm sure, that those cases don't relate to fraudulent transfer claims, but they do stand for the general proposition that if somebody gets a court order, they're entitled to rely on it. There are other cases cited at page 30 of our brief in the context of fraudulent transfer claims that do bear on this issue. Also, perhaps somewhat collaterally, but they do bear on it. Those cases of pages 30 and 31 talk about whether a creditor is acting in bad faith if they have no knowledge of insolvency. And those cases say, no, if you don't know you're insolvent, you know, then you can't infer that you were engaged in a fraud.
Okay, well, let's talk about knowledge because, okay, you didn't know there was an appeal. This is a preface to a question. Okay. At the time of the first four checks, you didn't know there was appeal because there was no judgment. They couldn't have appealed. But at some point, not too long after that, and I assume within 30 days of judgment being entered, your clients must have known that there was litigation pending challenging their entitlement to spend that money, correct?
By the judgment is entered in May, several months later, the appeal follows in due course. There is testimony in the record from both Mr. Henderson and Mr. Chigami that they were really unaware of the substance of what was disputed in the litigation.
But they knew litigation was pending.
They knew it was pending.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. Okay. So, and presumably, when the rest of the money left RFI, they knew that litigation was still pending.
Presumably.
Okay.
Presumably. But, of course, in 2002, Judge Chang says, don't worry, it's okay. Subsequently, this court says, don't worry, it's okay. And it's only in 2004, when the Supreme Court rules, that anybody draws into question whether the belief that Mr. Chigami and Mr. Henderson testified to, that they thought they were entitled to money and they could spend it for the business purposes of RFI, was challenged. You know, that it wasn't a belief.
So what did Judge Chang say in 2002?
Well, what he said was that RFI gets to keep the money. If I said 2002, I misspoke. Judge Chang said they get to keep the money. This court said, in effect, they get to keep the money. And it
an appeal was taken.
A further appeal was taken.
Okay.
Certiorari was sought. That's right. But again, you know, the case focuses directly on the four transfers. Finding of fact five, which is not challenged in this respect, says this case is about these four checks. And that's what they complained about in their complaint. That's what we went to trial about. And they can't expand it now by wishful thinking.
Well, but there is true, but I believe, Mr. Alston, there is evidence in the record of further transfers, and I believe it's undisputed by you as well, that there were further transfers in 2001 and 2002, and that prior to the 2004 Supreme Court decision, RFI was no longer solvent.
It was way wound down.
You'd have to agree. If we only look at those four transfers, and that's what the court did below, then there was solvency. But if you look at the broader behavior, there might be a solvency issue.
I would submit not in this sense, that as they were winding down, they were paying off. Or through distributions up to HSC, they were basically distributing out the assets in the belief that there were no other creditors that would have any stake in that money. Now, we cited cases, the Merkel case is one. There are others in our brief that focus on the fact that remote contingencies are not considered from
right, but isn't pending litigation a badge of, you know, making transfers during pending litigation or anticipated litigation? Isn't that a badge of fraud?
That's one. It's one of 11.
Right, but I mean, but isn't that something that?
Yes, except that at the time the transfers are made, when you then win, its weight as a factor, I think, diminishes to nothing.
Do you have a case for that proposition?
I do not, but I would say, you know, it is a factor, but just one of many. And the list of badges is not exclusive.
I agree. Yeah.
And the judge is entitled to weigh all that. I think we have to go back to first principles, which is where Judge Ginoza was leading with her questions, which is, they're attacking findings of fact made by a very experienced trial judge after a trial where he saw people testify.
Okay, and Mr. Alston, their attack on finding of fact five, as I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, isn't that the recitation of the four checks is wrong. It's that it's incomplete and that it doesn't really get to the other things, perhaps the later transfers. Isn't that really the gravamen of their attack on the findings, that if you just look at these, you know, four items in 8A, you're not getting the whole picture?
I would say generally that is true. I mean, they do try. In a brief that is, I submit, fatally out of compliance with the rules of this court, throw over 150 pages at you saying somewhere in here you'll find something that supports our position. If you confine to the brief, I would submit that they haven't made a good attack on any of those findings.
But as you know, Hawaii appellate courts try and reach the merits.
I know you do. And I know the Supreme Court has said you have to reach the merits even if the claim is time barred. And so
that's correct, Mr. Austin.
I know it is. But what I'm saying is it may be that there are other transfers later in time which were not attacked in the complaint and not part of their claim for relief, not part of any requested amendment, any amendment actually made, or any request under Rule 15 to have the claims conform to the proof. So we tried this case against the four, based on the four transfers.
Okay, so just to state that back to you, so there was never any claim before, during, or after trial to amend the pleadings to conform to the evidence?
There was none.
And so it was never argued that the later transfers were part of the course and conduct of fraudulent transfers?
You know, I think in fairness to them, they argued that in assessing the state of mind of RFI, you should consider all these things that happened after the four disputed transfers. But it was never in the context of saying, and by the way, give us that money back. I mean, it was in the context of the four disputed checks. That's what the complaint says. It doesn't talk about other transfers. And so that's what we went to trial. If I could, I'd like to finish up on the merits by saying that Judge Nakamura saw the witnesses. He heard them testify about what they thought, what they were doing, why they were doing it, and then concluded that the claimants didn't provide clear and convincing evidence of actual intent to defraud. And that, I think, is the overarching problem with their case. They may nibble at specific things. They may nibble at specific badges of fraud. But because the list is not exclusive and because it's ultimately a credibility-based determination that has to be made about actual intent, they haven't offered you anything on which you could say there was clear error. Let me here it's not just that he erred on findings of fact, but to reverse, you have to have because they have to prove a fraudulent transfer by clear and convincing evidence, you have to find that there is enough to support a, quote, firm conviction, and that it is highly probable that there was the actual intent to defraud. And so it's not just a matter of saying 51-50, it's a matter of saying them trying to satisfy a much higher standard.
Mr. Austin, on the, there's two sets of the findings of fact. There's kind of here's the, quote, suspicious circumstances, and then there's the other ones that he also weighed and said no clear and convincing evidence. One of them has to do with no expert witness on GAAP violations, GAAP accounting violations. I didn't see anything in your brief. Is there any requirement that they use GAAP accounting to establish insolvency?
No, but that goes back to what I mentioned about the Business Corporations Act. I mean, if under the Business Corporations Act a company distributes monies to shareholders, one of the relevant considerations about that distribution and about the potential liability that attaches to those sorts of distributions is whether they were relying on reasonable accounting principles. And so when Mr. Chigami testifies, what we did was consistent with GAAP. That has a bearing on actual intent, and if they wanted to say otherwise, they should have brought somebody in and say, oh, no accountant worth his salt would have believe that that could be done. And so I think that the judge was clearly mindful of that correlation.
Right, but and then on finding fact 9C, he talks about their failure to get a stay pending appeal. But I guess, Mr. Alston, I'm concerned about that because why would whether the, you know, allegedly defrauded party get a stay or not get a stay, what does that have to do with the defendant's actual intent or the transfer's actual intent to hinder, delay, or defraud? Isn't that completely off the point?
I would suggest not. And in this respect, I mean, even the act of seeking the stay would have alerted the company, or at least the company, I suspect the company as well as its lawyers.
But they didn't pay attention to seeking an appeal. Why would they pay attention to seeking a stay?
Well, I'm
would they have had grounds for a stay? Could they have gotten a stay? The cases I saw seem to suggest that a stay might have been denied.
It might have been denied.
You would have argued
they never tried.
Against it.
Never tried. And I'm sure that no doubt it would have been argued against. But,
right.
But it's a point that bears on efforts to try to make sure, efforts to inform the transferor of the circumstances. Let me turn briefly, if I could, to the merits, the statute of limitations argument, which the Supreme Court has said you are to decide. And I would suggest that even though Judge Nakamura did not make findings on that issue, there is, in fact, in the record, enough to resolve it here without a remand. And for that proposition, I start with the notion that, as we argued in our briefs, where they want to invoke the benefit of a tolling provision, a discovery-related tolling provision, it was their burden to prove that they could not have reasonably discovered the alleged fraudulent nature of the transfers earlier than they say they did. And we cited one case for that. There are many others. One would be the federal court decision in Warfield versus Alaniz, 453 F sub 2nd 1118, where they say it's the plaintiff's burden to demonstrate the justification for tolling. And here, the timeline, and I won't take the time to go show it, it's in the brief, but what you see is a long period, 6 months, 5 to 6 months, between the time when there is the final enforceable ruling on what they're owed and when they finally stir themselves into action and say that they made the discovery.
Well, Mr. Olson, let me ask it this way. What is the date, as a matter of law, that they reasonably could have discovered the fraudulent nature of the transfer? What the one date?
One date? I would submit that they could have discovered it within 60 to 90 days,
right,
after the order was entered saying that they are entitled to money.
Okay, that's sounding a little finding of fact-ish.
Well, perhaps it is, but what I'm saying is if you look at the record, you look at when they stirred themselves into action in March, and when they finally when they say they discovered everything in July, if you simply move that period back to when they were entitled to proceed, if they proceeded promptly, and then you put that together with the only evidence on this point in the record, and that is that Mrs. Schmidt testified that she instructed her lawyers to move as quickly as possible. She expected that as diligent lawyers, they would move as quickly as possible. And she doesn't have any explanation for why nothing happened. All she could do was speculate. This is in her testimony on page 21 on July 2nd. She speculates maybe it had something to do with waiting for a judgment. That's the full extent of the record and the evidence.
Mr. Olson, just to be clear, we're talking about after the Hawaii Supreme Court opinion and the case had gone back to the circuit court to determine the amount.
That's right.
So the judgment from the circuit court at that point.
Actually, it's the order from the circuit court that started the clock running. And I say that because, in fact, both parties waited for a judgment and then appealed, and the Supreme Court basically said, you dummies, you didn't need a judgment. Your appeal from the judgment should have been taken from the earlier order because no judgment was ever necessary or appropriate. So that's the point when you start the clock, when they should have, when they could have proceeded after the circuit court entered the order saying, yes, this is the amount you're owed. And at that point, within 10 days, they were free to hit the ground running. And the testimony is, that's what the plaintiffs expected. That's what they thought was going to be done. And it wasn't done.
Okay, so even assuming they filed a complaint that day that you say was reasonable, then you would have had an opportunity to answer the complaint, and then they would have had time to initiate discovery, and then you, I mean, well, isn't it, okay, well, let me just cut to the chase. Mm-hmm. What is your authority for this court finding that date, as opposed to sending it back to the circuit court to make that determination of the reasonable, you know, when it reasonably could have been,
right,
the fraudulent nature reasonably could have been discovered?
If it is their burden of proof, and if there is nothing in the record to explain their inaction for months, then I submit that sending it back when there is no evidence and it was their burden of proof is unnecessary. If you find, and there are, I admit there are cases going both ways on this issue. There are cases that say even when the tolling provision is invoked by a creditor, that it remains the transferor's responsibility to prove it. I can provide more sites if the court's interested on both sides of the issue. But even if it's our burden of proof, what we did was argue at trial there are gaps. There are months where nothing happens. And our argument on that point was not rebutted, so that the only evidence that exists is that they had an obligation to proceed. They could have proceeded before they filed lawsuit, because they did, and that they have no explanation. So if you just move the block of time between when they initiated their efforts to find out about these transfers and when they did find out, back to when they were free to act, and back when they were free to act based on their client's instructions to move as fast as possible, they ran out of time. So okay, that's why I don't think you need to remand.
Thank you, Mr. Olson.
Thank you. I think I've got about 5 minutes left.
Is it okay to resume?
Yes, Mr. Geschel.
All right.
It's okay with me.
I don't know how much time I've got left, but I want to say it.
14 minutes in.
14? Okay, thank you very much. Now, taking this in inverse order, Mr. Olson says that in, I guess, March of, let me think now, 2005? 2005, that the Schmitz and their high-powered lawyers could have found, should have been able to find it, that the that RFI was engaged in a fraudulent transaction and that they had fraudulent intent to transfer their money that they did back in 2000 when they hid it from the appellate court and they hid the fact from the trial court in 2004 after the Supreme Court, that we should have known that RFI, they had been transferring money fraudulently. Now, what a hogwash story that is. The only time we found out that this happened was when we got some checks from the money market account, and I think it was American Savings Bank, that RFI had separate accounts. See, it wasn't their operating account. It was their savings account. And they issued checks out of those, and then they dribbled it to us and said, give us a bank statement. Now, what can you tell from a bank statement in those days? Nothing, except the amount. Does that mean that there was a fraudulent transfer?
So your position is that it wasn't reasonable for you to know the fraudulent nature of the transfer until Mr. Chigami's deposition?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. That's when we learned that the company was
And what was, and the date of Chagami's deposition was July?
July 25.
And, but their argument is, but their argument is, how come you took so long to depose him? You reasonably could have done that earlier.
Because we were, as I recall, now that's 8 years ago, and I'm sure that my memory, I'm getting so old I can't even remember what day it is today, the 11th of February, but, I don't remember, Judge, but I think we were trying to coordinate it so that Mike Chagami could get over here, rather than us go over to the Big Island. He was going to come over here and be deposed at Ashford and Briston's office. That's my recollection. We were coordinating, and we never should have done that because we didn't know all the concealment that they were engaged in. If you look at the record, Your Honor, that from the time the Supreme Court reversed this case in March 18, 2004, it took us almost 9 months, could have had a baby in the time, between the time we got a judgment in front of Judge Blondin, and the reason that there was a delay, because RFI's powerful lawyers, Ashford and Riston, were making motion, making objections. It's full, the record is complete with all of the pleadings that they filed. Not one time did they say, what are we doing here for an accounting? What are we doing? Because the company doesn't have any money, so what are you bothering us for? They never said that. They concealed it all that time. And then they had the gall to stand up here and say, well, we should have discovered it earlier. And they were hiding the ball. If they had been honest about it, they would have said at the outset, we don't have any more money. Why don't you go find some other job to do?
You know, Mr. Geschel, I would like to ask you about the issue of concealment. I'm not saying that your case is dependent on it, but I'm really not understanding your concealment theory. I mean, they didn't have any duty to open their books up, or what did they do that was concealing this in the context of a badge of fraud concealment?
Well, it's pretty simple. They didn't tell us from 2004, after the judgment came in, that the company had no assets. The Supreme Court ordered an accounting for the fund.
I mean, did you demand money? What would have triggered them to tell you anything?
The Supreme Court decision.
Okay, so you're just saying they got the decision, they should have written you a check.
The Supreme Court said, we remanded for an accounting of what is due the Schmitz. And right then and there, that triggered, okay, I'm sorry, Schmitz, we ain't got no money, honey. It's that simple. Why didn't you guys go work some other place?
What did the accounting show at the time of the Hawaii Supreme Court opinion in March of 2004? Actually zero?
I'm sorry, I didn't follow your question.
When the Hawaii Supreme Court issued its opinion in March of 2004, indicating that the money, the excess should have gone to the Schmitz, what amounts were in RFI's accounts at that time? No, what amount was in RFI's accounts at that time?
None. I take it back. They had $1,300. They couldn't even pay their attorney's fees. They couldn't even pay the attorney's fees that the Supreme Court ordered. Ashford and Riston issued a trust account check of $10,400 to pay for me for the winning the appeal. They didn't even issue a check from RFI. They hid it right from the start. They didn't even pay, and we found out records later in discovery over in Hilo from the records of RFI. RFI didn't even have enough money to pay Ashford and Riston. Who paid it? HSC. And Henderson. The transferees. The ones that took advantage of raiding the company at the expense of the Schmitz, and then they laughed all away. Just laughed at us, basically. We can do whatever we want. In fact, Mr. Henderson said, I don't even pay attention to lawyers. I don't care what they say. And he's a CPA, and he used to be a state legislator here. So surely he knew the law. He was making them. But he violated them when they looted the company.
Okay, so...
So they concealed it, Judge.
So the concealment issue that you're talking about is after the Supreme Court's ruling, not so much back in 2000 when they wrote the checks. Because when they wrote those first four checks, they had no obligation, RFI, HS, no one had an obligation to report that to you or your clients.
No, because it was on appeal, okay. Your Honor.
Right.
In fact, what they did was, in February of 2000, they issued the checks 3 days after they got the sale proceeds, and 3 months before the judgment, the appealable judgment was filed in the foreclosure act.
Right, but for the purpose of determining whether concealment is a badge of fraud, don't you have to look at concealment at the time of the allegedly fraudulent transfers, not later?
No, because it's the nature of the fraudulent transfer, just like the Supreme Court decided.
Okay, so but
the nature of it, not just simply that there was a transfer. I think that's pretty well clear now. And Paul Alston cited 17 cases saying that it was wrong, that our version of the law was wrong, and the Supreme Court went to the length of distinguishing those, and I distinguished them, and they agreed with my distinction that Paul Alston's cases were not right, did not support his argument. And so it's the fraudulent nature. We discovered that when we took Chagami's deposition, and that's the first time. It's easy to see if you look at, let's say, General Motors. If General Motors pays all kinds of money out for parts or materials to make their cars, that's in the business. That's not a fraudulent transfer. It's a transfer of funds, but it's not fraudulent because General Motors has an ongoing business. RFI had no business. The FDIC was about to shut them down. In fact, that's why the stockholder had to fund $500,000 to keep it afloat and keep the FDIC out of their business. And so when they went out of business, what they did was their accounts are not their assets. It's what people owe the company. RFI was a thrift loan company. It's what people owe them. They're buy and sell money. So when you have, it's like when you deposit money with a bank, that's your money. It's not the bank's money.
Mr. Geshe.
So they sold their accounts to somebody else, and they bankrupted the company.
Let me ask you one more question, Mr. Geshe.
Sure.
And I don't need a record site because I can go back and check it. But what I want to know is, okay, before they got Kevin Chang's ruling in their favor,
yes.
Were there any payments out of RFI like these? Like, in other words, had they been paying up capital, repaying capital prior to that, or was it only after they got that what turned out to be a windfall?
I think, Your Honor,
is there evidence anyway in the record
that we did not deal with that,
okay.
Because the RFI. The FDIC, and this FDIC told RFI, you have got to fund $500,000 in Tier 1 capital.
At what point in time?
I think it was in 1998.
Okay, so probably capital was flowing in, not out of RFI.
It had to go into the RFI capital account so that they would be afloat and be compliance with the FDIC rules. Otherwise, I think it was a cease and desist order.
So why didn't they have to be compliant with
those
rules?
Because it was
lit. Right, but why didn't they have to continue to be compliant with that? I mean,
because I just said that they went out of business.
Yeah, at what date? When did they go out of business?
I think it was around 2000. It was in around 2000, maybe 2001, maybe 2002. They were in the process of going out of business. And they had to sell their accounts to some outfit over in the mainland.
And is that in Shigami's testimony? Where would I find the details of that in the record?
Oh, I don't know. Oh, Tom Dunn just told me, December 21, 1999.
31,
end of the year, 1999, they started closing their doors.
Okay.
Yeah. And what was that? Now I forgot their question.
No. He has the date, so I assume that he's looking at a document or testimony that backs that up in the record.
I'm pretty sure that there are exhibits in there.
Okay.
We got two.
That's okay.
It's just a. Most of the records came from the RFI and HSC records, because we don't have access to them. They had them, and everything we wanted, they just dribble it out, and then we go do this more discovery. That's when we found out that the $986,000 was paid in a period of like a year and a half after they got the sale proceeds. Which is mind-boggling, because their attorneys knew the case was on appeal. That I've cited you cases that say that the attorney's knowledge is imputed to the client. Therefore, they knew the case was on appeal. They knew the Smiths claimed the money was their money from the excess sale proceeds. Their lawyers knew that the statute says that. The statute and the Bank of Hawaii versus Horowitz said that. Now, David Farmer is a bankruptcy lawyer. He knew that. Therefore, RFI knew that. So that's all imputed to them. And they acted without regard to the law with two CPAs to go and loot this company. And now it's time to pay off.
Well, Mr. Geshaw, actual intent is a tough thing to show sometimes when you don't have an actual document showing somebody's mindset, right? So. The challenge in this case that I see is you're looking at all these circumstances surrounding RFI, and as you've just pointed out with your co-counsel, in December of 1999, they were winding down their business, or they decided to go out of business, I guess, because FDIC was on their tails at that point?
I'm pretty sure.
Okay, so I'm just going to finish up this question, if you can answer this for me. I mean, and the checks and all of that went out soon after that, in early 2000, right?
February the 9th.
Right. And one was in March or something. So it was within a couple of months of the end of 1999. So doesn't that cut the other way? Or how does it cut in your way? In the sense that they're going out of business, they're now writing checks to HSC's creditors.
Because the pleadings in the cases, in the foreclosure case, had already been filed, I believe, indicating that the Smiths claimed the excess sale proceeds.
So it's because the litigation was pending. That's
obviously
the key. But in terms of some of these other circumstances, I guess the question is, and I think what the trial court was struggling with is, were there good reasons, proper reasons, why these monies were being paid out? Given RFI's winding down.
Actually, they had, not they, the RFI had other assets, and I think they were, at that time, they had like about $1 million in their capital account. So they didn't need to go and do that. What they were doing was they used the RFI money to pay back HSC's loan from the First Hawaiian Bank and some other bank. That's what it amounts to.
It's the fact that they were paying off HSC's debts, not RFI's debts.
They used RFI's money to pay off HSC's debts. That's what it amounts to. Okay?
Thank you, Mr. Keshe.
Thank you very much.
There is no doubt that at the end of 99, RFI ceased operations and got out from under the scrutiny of the FDIC. They were not an operating business any longer. And at that point, Mr. Chigami and Mr. Henderson believed, and they testified, they didn't have any outstanding obligations, and they were free to wind up the affairs of the company, paying back investors as they did. Now, there was pending litigation, and the question is, could they have fought, or is there a reason for them to believe that they were going to lose that litigation? And is that, obviously, if they thought it was going to be a dead bang loser and it was only a matter of time before there'd be a day of reckoning, that would be a very different circumstance than where they actually won in this court and then only 4 years later have it overturned. So I think that that allegation that the pending litigation works against us is something that the judge weighed and rejected as a consideration here. Mr. Geschel argues that somehow the knowledge of the lawyer should be imputed to the clients. There's no basis for that in UFTA litigation, in proving actual fraud. Mr. Geschel says, I learned about the fraudulent nature of the transfer in July, which is off the chart because earlier the arguments have been focused on the day in April when they received the checks showing that the account of the company was depleted and that payments were being written to insiders. That's, I think, the appropriate day. But for this, for any of that, if you move that period, July to March, back in time when they were free to start their efforts here in October, they lose. They could reasonably have moved with diligence earlier in time and found everything that they rely on now before April 7, 2005. If they moved with the diligence that their client expected, and if that didn't happen, I would also note it's important here that back in 2004 they moved the company from RFI, and then in August of 2004 they actually started discovery into the assets of RFI, and they abandoned that effort. If they had pursued that to conclusion, we wouldn't be here because they didn't file suit until nearly 2 years later, a year and a half later, anyway. And the question on the statute of limitations is when could they have found out?
When could they reasonably have found out?
Yes. When could they reasonably have found out?
Well, but Mr. Alston,
yes.
I mean, even if I were inclined to think that your argument is more reasonable than his, mm-hmm. I mean, isn't the problem for this court really the fact, and this is a fact under Hawaii law, mm-hmm. that reasonableness is a question of fact in almost all cases. And he's saying it wasn't reasonable until they had the deposition. You're saying they reasonably could have gotten it at this point. Don't we need a trier of facts to decide that?
Let me suggest why you don't, and it is this. The evidence shows when they actually started efforts to find out and when they actually discovered. From the standpoint of what they could have done, the question becomes, is there any evidence in this record that supports the idea that they were somehow prevented from moving or taking those steps earlier? It was their burden to demonstrate why they couldn't have acted sooner, couldn't reasonably have acted sooner. They've offered nothing.
But that issue
to satisfy
wasn't
that
really
burden.
Decided by the trial court.
It certainly wasn't decided. It wasn't that we didn't tee it up with the testimony. I mean, the testimony was there for him to decide because I asked Ms. Smith, why did you delay? And all she could say was, maybe we were waiting for a judgment. Well, the judgment came down in December. If it was reasonable to decide to start in October, but even if it was reasonable to start in December, they didn't start in December. They didn't start until March. And therefore, having no explanation for the delay, it's not a question of when they should have discovered it, it's when they could have discovered it. And having offered no explanation at all for their delay, I submit they cannot go back, and there's no reason to go back and have the judge decide because they've offered no explanation for their delay.
Mr. Austin, is there any evidence in the record that the Schmitz or their attorneys were aware that RFI had been winding down his business in 2000?
They often, I'm not aware of any evidence in the record to that effect, Your Honor. there about it today.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Take the matter under advisement.